not moving waste gas and money. Obey the speed limit. Speeding reduces fuel mileage by up to 23%. Your gas mileage decreases rapidly once you get above 60 miles an hour. You have the power to make a difference. By taking these steps, you can save money and help our nation reduce its energy use.
For more tips on saving money at the gas pump, please visit our website at www.energy.gov or call toll-free 1-877-337-3463. This powerful savings message is provided by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Alliance to Save Energy.
And this is radio station WUSB Stony Brook. It's 6 o'clock. Time for Off the Wall. I guess we should just start early because we have so much to talk about, right?
Yes, we do.
All right. Well, it's Off the Wall. Emmanuel here. Kyle over there.
Yes, I'm over here.
You were mentioning the music.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that when we picked this song, I know that the first things that came to mind for me was the drums. They have that kind of marching band, kind of civil or Revolutionary War.
Yeah, like marching off to...
Yeah.
Make a difference. You know,
and we all, I think we felt that was sort of, it illustrated what we were sort of expecting from the change of administrations. And here we are on the precipice of real conflict. We have 40,000 troops surrounding Iran.
Is that what the number is right now?
40, I think so.
40,000, it's...
All told.
I mean, the numbers after a while stop meaning things because this has been going on for so long.
Well, when some of them get bombed, it'll mean something.
Yeah, but, I mean, we have lost. I was looking at the numbers earlier of just the number of people who have died in these wars that have been going on this entire century, if not beyond that. Almost 7,000 U.S. military deaths. That's deaths of our people in the military in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Actually, this is from 2016, so obviously it's above 7,000 by now. So, you know, we're closing in on 8,000, 10,000, you know, and then add in the contractors. That's more than 8,000 right there.
And that's not just average. Those are our bravest, our brightest, our best.
If you count the people who work in the military and the police of those countries that we're allegedly helping on the same side of, that's over 100,000.
Yeah, like interpreters,
yeah.
Translators.
National military, their soldiers, their police, or allied troops.
How about civilians?
Well, I'm getting to that. Kyle.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Ruin it. Trying to, you know, build up something.
I'm just trying to let you know I'm awake. I'm paying attention.
It's like 2,000 allied troop deaths. That's on top of the U.S. deaths.
Okay.
Civilians. more than a quarter million, probably a lot more than a quarter million, but that's the official number.
Got it.
So hundreds and hundreds of thousands. Opposition fighters, a couple hundred thousand of that. 500 journalists, almost 1,000 humanitarian NGO workers. It's disgusting. It really is. And for what?
We're under threat.
Well, when we started doing the show in 2003, that's when the second Iraq war was just gathering steam. Everybody was waving their flags, and we were already in Afghanistan. Since then, are we in a better state? Are we better off than we were then?
Wait. I was in Chicago at the federal building protesting going in at all when you started the show. And I was absolutely never a fan of this. I was against it from the beginning then.
The show?
No, I like the show. The show was great.
Okay, because that seemed awfully harsh against the show from the beginning. I know there are people who have been.
But I've never supported any of this, ever.
And again, you're not talking about the show. You're talking about the war and the military.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to distract. Yeah. I just want to be clear that, like you're saying, waving flag. Everybody. Not everybody. I wasn't.
But a lot of people were. A lot of people were. More so than now. But you know what else? There was also more opposition than now to what's going on. We've gotten so tired and just weary of the whole thing and convinced that it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't matter. Well, things are different now. Things are about to get much more different. And that's because our leader, our supposed leader, has tasted blood. Yeah. Donald Trump has assassinated another leader. And yeah, you know, you may not like him, but a general is a leader of sorts. And this is somebody in the Iranian military. Is that your phone?
Might be.
All right. I'm not saying turn it off. I'm saying just tell it to be respectful.
Here, I'll move it over here.
Yeah, put it over there. We don't turn our phones off anymore, folks, because we don't know what's going to happen when, and we need to be alerted. And that's nothing to be concerned about right now?
That's right.
All right, that's good. It makes a more shrill tone if we're supposed to be upset about something. Anyway, so, Trump has assassinated the leading general of the Iranian army.
The Quds Force, which is the force for stuff outside the country, which is a little counterintuitive. But let's just say he had a big role in projection of Iranian forces in the region.
Right.
And
the region,
he's like special operations and stuff. So he's like a very, very held in great reverence domestically because he was taking the fight, you know, outside the country, much in the way we do, actually.
Yes, you could say that. In fact, watching Trump today at a news conference, it seems like people of Iran should be thanking us because he was not a nice person. He was holding that country back. Basically, we're doing them a favor by assassinating such a nasty guy. But, you know, when I was watching the Reuters feed over the past couple of days of the funeral, there were a lot of people in the streets, and they weren't celebrating his death. Mm-mm. They were angry. Millions of people, and they're not just millions of religious zealots. They're millions of people of all kinds coming out into the streets, outraged at what the United States has done. It's an act of war. There is no question about that. In fact, even people in the administration know this because they're waiting for the retaliation. Although they're telling Iran, you better not retaliate. You know, we just did this to you, but if you hit back, you know, we're going to hit back even more, and it's going to be disproportionate and crazy, and we're going to go for your national heritage sites and everything. It's like we've become unhinged, and all of a sudden, I mean, imagine if that was a person, right? A person comes up to you and, like, punches you in the face and says, are you going to hit me back? If you hit me back, I'm going to do something even worse, you know? What would you think about a person like that? What would you do? I mean, I'd call a cop, but who's the cop in this situation? Crazy. Just today, Lindsey Graham tweeted this. We killed the most powerful man in Tehran short of the Ayatollah. Which means, in his world, killing the Ayatollah is definitely something we could consider. And can you imagine the simplistic minds that are running things right now, thinking that these are reasonable options. Look where we were. You know, back when this theme first started playing, and to expand on Kyle's point, yes, we changed the theme every time there's a new administration in the White House. And I'm getting awfully sick of this theme. I was hoping it would be changed by now, but no, we've still got it for a little while longer. But when we first started, before that, Iran had agreed not to develop any kind of nuclear weapon or even nuclear technology, period. They had signed a deal. They were abiding by it. Things were improving. And now they have the United States broke the deal, but for some reason Iran was still following most of it, and now they're out completely. You know what? Screw the rest of the world. We are going to develop all kinds of nuclear things. Just watch. And we're at the brink of war with them now. How are things better? I mean, just ask yourself that. Is this the victory you were looking for? This is the winning that we were all promised?
Think about it. They may be so mad they will bypass developing their own stuff and just buy the technology from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Stuff a bunch of warheads on a commercial jet or whatever they want. You know, they'll sort something out given how upset they are.
Yeah. And, you know, you have to, without seeming sympathetic to the guy himself, which I'm sure he wasn't a nice guy. You know, I'm sure people leading military campaigns usually aren't. And in particular, in that region, people get very hot-headed. I don't know if it's the heat. I don't know if it's just the occupation of U.S. forces. I'm not sure. But people have very short tempers, and he probably wasn't a very nice guy. It's got nothing to do with this. You know, we're not the cops of the world, and even cops don't have the right to simply kill people because they don't like them. Yeah, the guy was responsible for killing people that he was fighting. Our generals do the same thing. How many people have our generals been responsible for killing over there? Difference, folks, is that it's over there, not over here. Now, imagine if that guy was over here. Like, maybe he was in, well, I don't know, Canada. Sorry, Canada, but you're next door to us, just like Iraq is next door to Iran, as is Afghanistan. Now, let's say that Iran, for some reason, had forces in Canada, and they were basically invading there to do God knows what. I guess get rid of Trudeau or something. And, you know, we started to take an interest. We in the United States started to take an interest in Iran occupying Canada. Well, how would you feel about our generals who were fighting to get Canada back into Canadian hands? How would you feel about that person being assassinated because they killed other people that were killing us and killing people in Canada? It gets ridiculous when you think of it that way.
It's like you have, but don't forget about the maple syrup interests that we're protecting.
Like I said, it gets ridiculous awfully quickly. We forget. We seem to think we've got the right to be anywhere we want, doing anything we want. We really think we have that God-given right. Why are we over there? And this is something that even Trump was saying until fairly recently. He doesn't want to be over there. Wants to get all the troops back. Remember, that was only a few months ago. But no, we have the right to be there in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, and now Iran, and who knows, anywhere else we want to be. And we can tell the people over there, you don't have the right to develop this kind of technology. You don't have the right to fight back if we hit you with something. You don't have the right to defend your own people. You don't have the right to practice your religion without being seen as a threat to the entire world. Let's look at history just a little bit, okay? And Kyle, feel free to jump in, because I did a bunch of research earlier, but I knew most of this. I think a lot of people do. But Iran's been around for a long, long time. Compared to us, you know, as Persia, they have been around for many centuries. And they have always, always been able to kick out anybody trying to invade them. They have never been colonized by European powers, that is, unlike other countries in the region. And in the 50s, They elected democratically a prime minister, Mohammed Mossadegh, I believe is how you pronounce his name. Completely democratically elected. Sounds good, right? You know, nice, independent, democratic country over there in the Middle East.
But do we approve of him?
Well, here's what he did, you see. He tried to audit the documents of a company known as Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, AIOC. They were part of British Petroleum, BP. They wanted, or he wanted, to limit that company's control over Iranian oil reserves. The nerve, all right?
Natural resources,
he
in other words.
He wanted this company that was part of British Petroleum, he wanted them not to have control over the oil reserves in the country that he was a leader of. So the company did the only thing that they could do. They refused to cooperate with the Iranian government. Yeah. And so the parliament of Iran, and this is in 1953, by the way, they voted to nationalize Iran's oil industry and expel foreign corporate representatives from the country. Now think about that. Do they have the right to do this? Do they have the right to say, hey, you're exploiting our natural resources. Either you work with us or you get out. And we take over our natural resources. Do they have the right to say that? That's a very simple question. I would say they probably do. They have the right to control what's going on in their own country, right? I mean, sure, the company probably invested something. Maybe they could work something out. I don't know, but it's still their land. That's what it comes down to in the end. It's their land. It's like, their country.
It's like if South Africa kicked De Beers out and said, no more, these are our diamonds or something, you know? I don't even know if that's where diamond mines are, but...
Wow. Yeah, well, there's an idea for you.
But that's a monopolistic private entity in mm-hmm. in a country that has some mineral rights, but the country could say that this is exploitative and it's hurting us and we no longer want you, we're no longer granting you those mineral rights.
Well, the U.S. didn't like this very much. And so, along with a U.K. leader you may have heard of named Winston Churchill, our president, Dwight Eisenhower, decided to overthrow Iran's democratically elected government. And we did, with the CIA. We went in there, overthrew their government, and installed the Shah of Iran. Shah of Iran, brutal dictator, ruled with an iron fist, not democratically elected, from 1953 until 1979. I still remember the demonstrations right here on campus against his rule.
I just want to interject on Washington Journal. A lot of the phone calls, the history pretty much stops there.
This is the C-SPAN.
Yeah, when people call in and they start, it's pretty good. Like they walk back the history. They go about that far, but they don't really acknowledge the history any further than about 79. People seem to want to forget anything in that period.
You know why? Because 1979, that's when you see a lot of people in the streets demonstrating. The Ayatollah comes back from Paris. And they hate us. They hate us so much. Why do they hate us? We're Americans. You know, what did we ever do to them? Well, this is what we did to them, okay? Go back to 1953, and you see what we did, why they hate us so much. After 26 years of being under a dictatorship that they did not ask for, after having their democratically elected leader basically killed because he was arrested and kept in solitary confinement in his home until he died, that is something you hold a grudge over. And, it turned into radical fundamentalism. Not the best thing in the world. But who did that? Was it them? Not really. No. We definitely helped that along.
I think the collective memory, I mean, the people that were adults that would remember that back then mm-hmm. are no longer with us. And we've willfully forgot that history.
So you're at 1979 now. The Ayatollah takes over. It becomes a fundamentalist regime and definitely not a good place to be for a lot of people.
But it's better for us.
It's not really better for us. No, not at all. It's awful for us.
Well, with the dictator, with the person we've installed.
1979, when the Ayatollah takes over. That's where we are now.
Oh, I'm sorry. You jumped ahead.
I jumped ahead. Sorry. 1979. It's not a nice place to be. And basically...
But that's a backlash, essentially.
It is a backlash. You have to understand how we got there.
Yeah.
And what do you do at that point? How do you fix the situation? Well, I mean, they took the hostages in the embassy. Definitely not good. But I don't know. You know, you're in a difficult situation then of your own making. You have to try and work something out, and we have not tried to work anything out with this regime. We have not tried in any way to treat them with respect and try to win them back over and apologize for what we've done in the past. And so you wonder why people in Iran have this distaste for the United States. At least maybe you can understand that, but I think most people just haven't paid attention. They don't care. They don't want to know. And that is basically the background why this country is so anti-American. It didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of our actions. And the only way to fix that is to have new actions that are better, that are more respectful of a country's independence,
sovereignty, and that use mechanisms of actual diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
And we seem to have forgotten that. And I think the most glaring example in the last week was seeing Mike Pompeo speaking as an arm for the Defense Department. In fact, we didn't hear from Mark Esper, who is the actual Secretary of Defense. We did not hear from him until this week.
Until today, I think.
Yeah. So Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, the job Hillary had, mind you, he has been basically beating the drums of war and using the State Department as an extension of the Department of Defense. Since when was the State Department part of the Department of Defense? It is supposed to be tasked with representing our interests overseas, not our plans for defense and invading, or at least those mechanisms are something that are a last resort when all of the mechanisms he has in the State Department of diplomacy, all the mechanisms and tools of ambassadors and things like sanctions and so forth, which we had been using, that's his wheelhouse. And yet, all we're hearing from him is military strategy, mm-hmm. and accusations of hypothetical attacks, and then no evidence. Oh, I'm sorry, we can't get into that. Oh, no details. No, sources and methods are something I can't divulge from Secretary of State.
Well, yeah, that's
I expected from Mark Esper.
Uh-huh. People are asking this question. So, what is this this imminent threat that we were supposedly defending ourselves against that made us feel assassinating this guy was the right thing to do? And they won't tell us. They won't tell us what those threats were. Imagine that.
Not only that, they won't tell Congress.
Yeah.
They barely told the Gang of Eight.
Well, there was just a briefing. It happened, it might still be happening for all I know. And members of Congress are finding out something about what's going on.
I heard an interview with Jackie Speier today. She's seen it and was speaking out about it.
Okay, so maybe it's already over then. But, we're going to find out more, I hope. But for now, it's very mysterious. And if you look at it, what's the guy's name, Kyle? The guy that we killed? I don't know. I don't remember his name. It's in the news all the time, but come on. Can you honestly say you remember his name? I mean, I have to look at something to find the guy's name. I certainly don't know how to pronounce it.
Start with an S?
Yeah, it does start with an S.
Simmons.
No, wait, it's the other guy.
No.
No. Bobman, that no, that's it's hard to find here.
Like an S and an M and an I.
Oh, there he is. Soleimani.
Soleimani, yeah.
Qasem Soleimani.
Qasem Soleimani, like
I'm Salamander. Sorry, that name is not ingrained in my head yet. You call me an ignoramus if you want, but, you know, Osama bin Laden, yeah, everybody knew that name. That name was everywhere. People knew that was the bad guy. That was the terrorist. You cannot compare Obama having that guy killed with this, someone who's part of a regime, an actual existing sovereign nation, all right? And if you look, you know, everybody communicates through Twitter these days. So if you look at Twitter histories, go through all these people and see how many of them ever said this guy's name before a few days ago. So it's very hard to believe the story that we're being told that this guy was the most wanted. No, first of all, he wasn't the most wanted anything. I've looked on the most wanted list. I look at that every day, believe me. And he is not on, he wasn't on it. He was not on it. So you can say now, yeah, we killed this guy that was going to kill people that we like, which is not surprising because you're killing people that he likes. You know, it's kind of you're occupying land over where, you know, in his backyard. That's the kind of thing that happens. But there's no actual evidence that he was sought after by an international criminal court. He was not on the FBI's most wanted list of terrorists. So a lot of this is just cleaning up after your own mess.
Well, let's also point out that the Revolutionary Guard was only recently added as a terrorist organization, and it was added. There's another talking point that Mike Pompeo is using as like a go-to rationalization that, oh, well, he represented a terrorist organization. Yeah, it's an organization that this administration designated as a terrorist organization. And for that matter, what if they designate our military as a terrorist organization? It's about that valid. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like tit-for-tat name-calling from state entities. So, and none of that really matters. You know, any nation out there could label us a terrorist organization. NATO could label us a terrorist organization. Then what?
Mm-hmm.
What?
If only they had the guts. You know, because we do so many things that are worthy of rebuke, and we never get rebuked. And we say this all the time. World, other countries, organizations, hurt us with something. Slap us across the face when we do something bad. Don't let us get away with it. Because when you do, we just keep doing it, and we do it worse.
Yeah, I'm surprised people don't sanction us.
Sanctions! Look!
At least a little teeny sanction, like 10 cents on that maple syrup I was talking about.
We talk about the BDS movement and how that is not anti-Semitic. Okay, well, a similar movement against this country is certainly not something that we don't feel is unjustified, that we feel is unjust, because there are reasons for these things. You have to react when something is unjust. And then maybe the people who are perpetuating the injustice will think about it and say, okay, is this who we want to be? Do we want to continue doing this kind of thing? We need reaction. And instead, you know, what we get are just accept this. You get the UN saying, okay, everybody just calm down. After we assassinate somebody, you're telling everybody to calm down.
calling for restraint.
Yeah. How about you let them get their retaliation and then you tell us to calm down? How's that going to play out? You know, and I don't know. What do you think is going to happen at this point? Because everyone's saying, yeah, they have to retaliate. It's almost like, you know, if you don't retaliate, there's something wrong with you. And first of all, there's a lot of people in Iran.
Well,
there's almost 100 million people in Iran. So that's a sizable number of people for a relatively small area of land. But, you know, they have to respond in some way to having somebody that high up in their government assassinated by us. You can't just say, okay, we have to, you know, negotiate something. I wish it were that simple. I wish we could just, you know, forget about it and move on. But I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, you saw the reaction when our country bombed people in a particular militia. That led to the demonstrations outside the embassy in Iraq, in Baghdad, which supposedly was one of the reasons why we struck at this guy, because we objected so much, even though nobody was killed, we objected so much to having our embassy stormed by demonstrators, and we said this guy helped plan that. Okay, still a reaction to death, a reaction to murder, and demonstrations seem like a nice way to do that. But now, you know, if you demonstrate against us, we're going to kill somebody that you like, and we tell them, no, you can't react to this. What world are we living in?
Well, I have a lot of different things that I think are going to happen. I think everything's on the table and all of the above. I think specifically, like I mentioned earlier, that Iran may not even go so far as to develop their own ICBM or nuclear weaponry. They may just buy it specifically from North Korea, given the history. I read a book, Dear Leader, Great Leader, which is all about North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks a lot about how advanced the missile technology was, and that North Korea was selling, and a lot of the states they were selling to were places like Iran. Iran has also purchased a lot of equipment and things from Russia, and they have a history of that. So, I mean, it is certainly possible, and they're a developed enough nation with means and resources, and now a lot of people willing to contribute. So I don't think, you know, when money's involved, they're going to look at the market of what they have available to them, and they're going to try to use that against us. And so, and North Korea is certainly willing to sell. They may have trouble moving things around, but I do not at all think that it is outside the realm of possibility that some of the advanced weaponry North Korea is developing doesn't end up in state actors' hands that are willing to perhaps use that stuff, whether it's locally in the area or if it's elsewhere abroad. I think all of the soldiers there now are pretty much targets. They're probably going to try to bomb something and get a very high number of troops killed.
That's the tragedy of this whole thing.
There'll be hostages.
Soldiers, people we know, people we respect, friends, relatives, who are over there thinking they're serving democracy, they are in the crosshairs, and I consider them to be innocent too, you know, unless they're perpetuating war crimes or torturing people or things like that. They are misled into serving a regime that does not have their best interest at heart. I don't think, though, that Iran or most other countries are insane enough to use nuclear weapons. I just don't. Because, you know, the backlash against them at that point, both morally and physically, would just be too great. I do think there are many other options for them to explore. I don't have the same faith in the current leadership of this country, though. I think they are so full of themselves, think they run the world so much that they think, oh yeah, we can drop a couple of tactical nukes on this country and get away with it. And you know what? They probably could get away with it because nobody is pushing back. Nobody is punishing us.
If they framed Iran properly, mm-hmm. they could probably justify it because of our policies of mutually assured destruction and so forth. So even if Iran makes some move in any of those directions, whether they're developing things internally on the nuclear scale or trying to acquire them, as history has told us, specifically with ICBMs, we'll simply take out very large swaths of the country, and whether it's on a large scale or a smaller scale, it will be that we were defending ourselves. And it's so funny that language was used a lot, that all of these actions are defensive, but when you really look at the actions, it's offensive.
Right.
Killing this general was offensive,
of course.
And it's being characterized as a defensive move.
Yeah, everything we're saying, and by we mean our current regime, unfortunately, they do represent us. But everything that we are saying right now is basically we're the victim somehow. And the history I've just outlined, you have to ask yourself, where exactly is the United States the victim in any of this? You talk about mutual assured destruction, which is a policy that that we pretty much had with the Soviet Union and China over decades. That basically worked then because you had superpowers. It's not mutual anymore. We can destroy Iran. Iran cannot destroy the United States. It's just not possible. It's not something that is physically doable. And that's why I think they're not crazy enough to start something like that. We, on the other hand, are so full of arrogance and overconfidence that we can get away with just about anything we want to do.
I don't think that's true. I think that as even places like China and Russia, whether they really agree on like a fundamental or religious side of the equation, whether, you know, if they're whether they're aligned or not, religiously or fundamentally, they have certain other interests specifically against the U.S. Mm-hmm. So maybe Iran can't destroy us, but I think there are a lot of there may be alliances being formed around our aggression that we're unaware of or too naive to think are a reality. And okay, fine, maybe it's not something involving nuclear doom and gloom. I don't mean to go there. It is in the lexicon of what's being talked about, and seems to be something we're not afraid of talking about as a defense, as a tactic. But let's, I mean, even electronic and so-called cyber warfare, that's certainly a possibility.
Of course, yeah.
Whether Iran does that internally or whether they form an alliance with nation states that are not in our interest, as I said, Korea,
you know, I'm willing to give them
places.
That. Go after our cybersecurity. You know, why not? Have at it. We'll recover from that, and you can get some revenge that way without actually killing people. That might be better. But are you saying, though, with nuclear weapons, that if we were to strike Iran, that Russia would have their back? Because Russia has not been very strong in condemning. I mean, they've condemned, but they haven't condemned in a strong language as I would expect. And China has not either. So I don't know if they want to get involved. I don't think they would do something to defend Iran or to retaliate for something that happened to them.
Well, I mean, it's certainly in their interest to sell equipment, because that's something you can just perpetual. That's something you can go back to.
They would do that.
Get your beak wet, so to speak, mm-hmm. and that's all good. But I in the back of my mind, I think that brazenness, this we run the world thing, at a certain point is going to go to our heads. Beyond, and especially in alienating NATO and disintegrating alliances that are buffers against the East, with Western Europe specifically, we may go back and find our alliances aren't as strong as we think.
That is exactly what we should find, and we need to be feeling the pain for what we have done. As a citizen of this country, that is my strong feeling that, you know, actions carry reactions and consequences, and something like this should not just stand and be considered the status quo. Because, as I said, you know, Trump has tasted blood now. He thinks he can get away with it. He knows what it's like. And, the next time he'll just, move ahead and think that, nothing ever happens to me. I don't lose any power. Nobody can stand up to me. I'll just keep going ahead and, a wish list of what I want where. We can't let that happen. But here's the thing. And by the way, here's our phone number, 631-632-9872. Call us. Let us know your feelings over the next few minutes. The reaction here in this country, pathetic. Absolutely pathetic. We were listening to some good radio coverage of demonstrations going on in various parts of the country on Saturday. But the numbers, a couple hundred people here. Really? A couple hundred people? That's all the people that are turning out to voice their strong opposition to us assassinating people in other countries and standing on the brink of yet another war and sending our kids over there to die for nothing. A couple of hundred people. Should be tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people. We should be storming the damn White House, okay?
Yes.
Drag that guy out onto the street and kick him out and replace him with somebody who has some sense. That's just my feeling. That's just my opinion. But that's how things go in democratic countries when somebody is not playing by the rules, when somebody is abusing their power. You do something about it. Look at every single Western European country. We just saw a documentary about the Pentagon Papers, and we saw how every single country that was involved in South America and Europe and Asia, even Iceland,
Panama.
People were storming the streets and surrounding buildings and demanding action, demanding change. And they got change. People resigned. People kicked out. People went to prison. In our country, nothing. Just run-of-the-mill, that's what happens, can't do anything, got to go to work, got to buy a new washing machine, and that's it. And that's why we have no calls, because we're all fat cats comfortable in our consumerism. That's just my jaded opinion right now.
I just wanted to clarify, it's the Panama Papers, not the Pentagon. It's been a
Freudian slip there, wow.
It's been a very defense-oriented show so far, but there's a film from 2018... that is about the Panama Papers.
There are a lot of films about the Panama Papers.
Yeah, and Mossack Fonseca, I believe, is the law firm in Panama, mm-hmm. and basically they orchestrated a lot of the off the books hidden, I guess, tax evasion. Which is distinct from tax avoidance,
right.
Especially with the wealthy. You need to be clear, like, you have avoidance, which is, you know, this is all my income, but I've structured and handled my affairs such that, you know, I'm avoiding being overtaxed. That's one thing. But what happens is the same systems, and I would, dare I say, people with means have more access to these systems. These same systems are used to hide and obfuscate income, and it can then become a vehicle for extorting public funds. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, the subject really and the crux of it is that a lot of politicians, a lot of very powerful people, oligarchs, you name it, across this globe partake in using that system to completely evade paying any tax at all. And this is to say nothing of corporate loopholes and other sorts of avoidance.
There's only so much negativity we can focus on in one show, but that's a whole show in and of itself, and we do recommend investigating that. Panama Papers, fascinating subject matter.
Really good reporting from ICIJ and reporters around the world.
631-632-9872. Phone lines close in 5 minutes if you have anything to say about this. Here's a story. Even as federal officials continue to deny that Iranian Americans have been stopped at the border, more Iranian-born people have come forward with accounts of having been detained and questioned, and a growing chorus of officials and civil rights advocates in Washington state came to their defense yesterday. Nega Hekmati, her husband and their two children, arrived at the U.S.-Canada border late on Saturday after a ski trip, planning to return to Washington state, as they had many times before. They carried Nexus cards showing they'd been pre-screened by U.S. Customs and Border Protection for expedited processing. And what they received was anything but. When immigration officers determined that she and her husband were born in Iran, they told them to park their car and bring their children into a room where others with Iranian heritage were also being held. The 38-year-old interior decorator and her husband, a Microsoft engineer, were subjected to intensive questioning during a five-hour overnight ordeal. The children were afraid to go to sleep in case their parents were taken away. She said they shouldn't experience such things. They're U.S. citizens. She was one of several Iranian Americans who had have offered detailed accounts of being pulled aside and questioned in days since President Trump ordered the targeted killing of an Iranian general. They said the officers took their passports, kept them waiting for five or more hours after determining they were of Iranian ancestry, a procedure that a leading Seattle immigrant rights attorney called illegal. Doesn't matter anymore, though. Doesn't matter if it's illegal. Our leaders don't care about the law. They don't care about what courts say. They refuse to send witnesses to answer subpoenas. They operate with impunity. They will continue to do this. This has happened countless times before in other places, and it's happening now here. It will get worse. We can file all the papers we want. They will ignore the rules. They will ignore the laws, and they will make new laws and have things the way they want to have them, both within our borders and outside our borders. We are seeing that, and it's disgusting. And what's really disgusting is that we're letting it happen. We're just letting it happen.
Well, we are so paralyzed. I mean, just think about how little is going into really important things, like the Department of Education. I mean, you name it. I mean, as we were alluding to with tax evasion and stuff, it's like, you know, the very things that support people enough for them to have maybe some spare time to care about this stuff or to know that they could maybe quit their job for a week and protest. Like, people are so paralyzed by how little there is for them, whether, you know, they're being victimized by low wages or, you know, all of the above. I can't fault people for not being able to devote the time they need to be devoting to stand up and say something about it. And unfortunately, maybe general strike or something like that needs to be, you know, have a second look.
Yeah.
But
well,
we're not brave enough. We're paralyzed by the very system that isn't working for us.
It's more about just not having time. It's also about not wanting to stand out, not wanting to be noticed and to be seen as somebody who causes trouble.
Strength in numbers, people.
And to not have all the facts either, to not, you know, to want to believe what you're being told and not actually question that. It's understandable, but it's exactly what those people want you to do. And that's how these bad things happen throughout history. That is how you get led down roads that you don't want to go down in the end. But you don't realize you're down the road until you're down the road. And that's what we're trying to wake people up to, that we're going down a very dark path. And we don't know where it's going to wind up. We don't know what's going to happen because we are setting things up to be very negative indeed, where we are on the wrong side of history, to put it simply. All right, well, not a single phone call came in. Not too surprised, I'm sorry to say. That's how America is these days. Don't really care. Yeah. All right, well, you know, we have other things to talk about as well. Shall we go to the film? Yes, it's time for Films of the Year That Was. That's when we see an Academy Award-winning film for one year or another. And we're up to 1965. And guess what? It's another musical. The Sound of Music. Yeah, we just saw My Fair Lady from 1964. In 1965, The Sound of Music won the Academy Award. So, yeah, we have a lot of tunes in our head as a result. Now, interestingly enough, this film is... It touches upon some of the same subjects that we're talking about right now. About ominous marches into darkness led by militaristic leaders who think they can get away with anything. And we're talking about Austria in the late 30s, right before Germany marched in. That's when The Sound of Music takes place, when all this is starting to happen. Now, you know, it's a very sweet, sugary tale of a prospective nun who is sent to be a governess for seven kids. Their father is a captain. They lost his wife. He's very strict. And she's sent to take care of his kids, and
he warms up to her. Warms up in general.
You've catapulted to the end of the film, yes, but she has to get the kids on her side and teach them to sing and play and things like that because they're not allowed to play. Now, this is based on a real story, but he wasn't nearly as nasty. The captain wasn't nearly as nasty, and the kids actually already knew how to sing. But it doesn't matter because it's based on reality. Basically, a lot of this is just showing scenery from Austria, from Salzburg, and basically opening up to positivity and light and just being a kid, teaching kids that they can be kids. That's the important thing. And it's, you know, a lot of classic musical numbers. And
beautiful scenery. A lot of it is on location in Austria.
Mm-hmm.
And aerial shots. The whole beginning of the film is really astounding aerial shots, mm-hmm, of the hills in Austria and the scenery there. I mean, we've been to Salzburg, I think you mentioned maybe. And it is...
I didn't know Sound of Music was based in Salzburg when we were in Salzburg. I wish I did.
Yeah.
We'd have at least gone to the castle.
Of course, yeah.
Or
yeah,
gone to that hilltop where, you know, the hilltop where Julie Andrews is spinning around singing The Sound of Music. That's at the very beginning of the film. I didn't know that. I thought it was the culmination of the film, but that's how right. It begins.
Yeah, she's singing to herself and then returns to the monastery and asks forgiveness. I just couldn't help it. I had to go, and the hills, the beautiful day was calling to me. I just had to sing.
Uh-huh.
And
what they went through to make that scene, they had to run out there because it was raining constantly, and then suddenly the sun came out. So they're like, hey, Julie, get out there now and do the dance. And there's a helicopter coming up behind her. In fact, you can see the grass like blowing sometimes to get the shot. And at some point you see the sky is cloudy, then the sky is sunny. Making these films can really be a very taxing enterprise.
Oh, yeah. It's incredibly difficult, especially on location, wherever you are, but in mountainous terrain. I mean, all the equipment and lighting and support is it's no small feat.
No, not at all. It's another lengthy film, about 3 hours with an intermission.
It's also shot in Todd-AO, which is a proprietary format.
Mm-hmm.
And that was used in the film we talked about a couple years ago in our project.
In our project, yes.
Yeah, I believe it was Around the World in 80 Days, this camera technology, which is basically higher resolution. I think it's bigger than 70 millimeter and uses a special camera and all this sort of special film stock. It is really beautiful to see the print, as in Around the World in 80 Days, seeing that full modern resolution, like on wide screens and so on, that most people have now, is a lot different than maybe in music class in grammar school on an old CRT television, you know, or VHS.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's when I first saw The Sound of Music. So revisiting it, I think, was, again, really, really beautiful. I know, I feel like I say that for all of these films. Oh, they're so beautiful. Well, it's really cool to see remastering, and you get the detail, you get the landscape, of course, and just appreciate some of the subtleties. The other thing I realized, I think, seeing this film as an adult, is the dialogue. A lot of cutting remarks, some of the humor.
Yes.
Of course, the history and references to political stuff or the military or the invasion and things to come, et cetera, et cetera. You don't really know that when you're younger. And, you know, it just seems like a lighthearted film, love story, whatever. Well, you know, the Baroness, who is originally the captain's love interest, she has these various conniving things that she does to Maria to get her out of the way or out of the picture.
Well, in the film, she just basically was after the captain, and yeah, she tries to manipulate Maria, played by Julie Andrews, to you know, go back to the nunnery or whatever, so she can marry this guy. But in the original play, the original musical, she actually believed that he should work with the Nazis, and he was very much, the captain was very much against working with the Nazis, and that was really what the conflict was that broke them up in the end, was that she wanted to collaborate.
In the real story?
Or cooperate. In the original, yes.
The thing it was based on?
Yeah, the musical on Broadway.
Okay, I see. So they changed some of the screenplay.
Yes, they changed.
Or they changed it for the screenplay.
They changed some of the screen, and they also changed some of the music. They added a couple of songs for the film. They took away a couple of songs from the Broadway musical. The song Edelweiss.
Yeah.
Which I always thought was a German song or an Austrian song. It's in fact, it's the intro to A Man in the High Castle, which is, you know, the Philip K. Dick TV presentation.
Dystopian.
What if the Nazis won? What if there are all these different worlds, things like that? But, you know, the song was written by Rodgers and Hammerstein for this in the 1950s, so it has nothing to do with that. In fact, if you go over to Austria, people don't know that song. And, in fact, people don't even know this film in many parts of that region. For ages in Germany, they just cut out all references to Nazis. This is West Germany. They just made it a different film.
Yeah.
And you had no idea that's what this was really about, that was going on in the background.
Yeah.
So it was fascinating to watch, though, and see it all unfold.
There was a lot of it that was done in Hollywood, right? The 1617 song, that looked very much like a soundstage. I mean, it wasn't all on location.
Not all of it, no.
But
it's funny because they talked about walking down the hallway to open the door in Hollywood, and the door opens in Salzburg. things like that happen when you make a film.
Of course. Did some of the puppetry exist in the Broadway production?
I don't know if it's the same puppet.
Or marionettes?
Yeah, they had a puppet show in the middle of this.
But did that transfer from the stage version, do you know? Or okay.
I mean, it's they probably did some degree of that.
It's a big element of it. They do various little storytelling and stuff. Obviously, the children are involved in the marionettes, and it's a very playful bit of storytelling within the story. So
yeah, and it was a real Von Trapp family, you know, they took exception to some of the things in the film and liked other things that took place, and there were more kids too. I think there were 10 kids, not 7. That's because Maria had kids with the guy too, and they actually got married in 1920. So this whole escaping from the Nazi thing didn't work quite the same way. In the film, they actually escape by walking or driving up the mountain and then walking into Switzerland, which is impossible if you know where Salzburg is, because Salzburg is very close to the border with Germany, and that's exactly where they didn't want to go. And in real life, what they did was they hopped on a train and just went to Italy. And then escape to the UK from there. So there's a lot of liberties that are taken. But when you're making a film, yeah, you take liberties. That's kind of what the whole production is.
And probably fits with like post-war American narrative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having just defeated the Third Reich and stuff.
Yeah, totally. It was definitely, a lot of people didn't like it at the time they were making it. They thought it was too saccharine, you know, too sweet. It was, very, I don't know, sentimental and just, I think people were kind of sick of that then. They wanted something
new. You know, when I realized that is when the nun starts singing.
Uh-huh.
And you're not allowed to sing in the monastery. So she breaks her own rules and sings to Maria. And at that point.
What do you mean you're not allowed to sing in the monastery?
Well, the whole reason Maria was apologizing for singing and the reason that the head nun said it was okay was that she wasn't within the walls of the convent. But there's a moment where Maria revisits and comes and talks to the nun, and she starts singing to her in the convent. It just that.
Oh, yes. When the mother, what do they call that in the nunnery? The head mother? Or there's a word for it. We don't know? Okay, whatever. The
sister.
Know, no, but she's the top gun in the nunnery.
I just said head nun.
Head nun, fine. That's not
chief,
what it's called. But
chief nun?
I'm sure it's not called that either. She started
Mother
singing.
Superior.
Thanks. I don't know if that's it. But, yeah, let's just call it Mother Superior. She starts singing a song towards the end of the film, and they had such trouble getting her to sync with the – everybody was dubbed pretty much for singing.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, I guess.
And maybe not Julie Andrews, but most everybody else. But she had such trouble starting with the sync that they – when you see her start with a song, she's in shadow so that she could get up to speed. And when she turns her head, she's finally synced up. It took forever to get to that point.
That is a really interesting a bit of information. Given how much the lighting plays an important role, I mean, there's this incredible night lighting and mood lighting and so on for various scenes. And, of course, inside the convent, it's lit very in a very interesting way. And that scene, of course, yeah, the shadow is... I was wondering about that because is this some kind of noir or some something they're trying to convey here? Is there something to be from this that I should be drawing some meaning from? But no, it was a technical thing.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's The Sound of Music, 1965. Haven't yet gotten to the foreign film from 1965 yet. We'll probably do that for next week. It's a bit of history. It's worth seeing, and it's worth seeing how other bits of history were treated. In this production, I want to go out this week with something that's kind of apropos to what we've been talking about and this film, because it's one of the songs that was in the Broadway production that was not in the film. They took it out. It's called "No Way to Stop It," and it's about collaborating with the Nazis. And someone is basically saying, you know, there's no way to stop this. You have to pretty much work with these people. You can pretend you're working with them and not really believe that you're working with them. And they kind of expand that to be there's no way to stop the universe. There's no way to stop all these other things that just are forces of nature. I don't know if Nazism is a force of nature, but that's how they were treating it at the time.
These violent delights have violent ends, people.
Absolutely. And the forces around us, they are not absolute either. You can affect them. You can change them. You can speak out against them, please. If not on this show, speak out somewhere. Speak out to your family, your friends, whatever. And you can always write to us. Yeah, I know writing is passe as well, but otw@2600.com, that's our email address. We love getting letters. We love hearing other people's thoughts. It's kind of the whole point. Please write to us, otw@2600.com, and... enjoy the music from Sound of Music that was not in the film.
You dear, attractive, dewy-eyed idealist, today you have to learn to be a realist.
You may be bent on doing deeds of daring do, but up against the shark, what can a herring do?
Be wise, compromise.
Compromise and be wise.
Let them think you're on their side, be noncommittal.
I will not bow my head to the men I despise. You won't have to bow your head, just stoop a little.
Why not learn to put your faith and your reliance
at a cockeyed angle. We make a cockeyed circle round the sun. And when we circle back to where we started from, another year has run.
And there's no way to stop it, no, there's no way to stop it. If the earth wants to roll around the sun, you're a fool if you worry, you're a fool if you worry. Oh, my head is in the little number one.
That's you.
That's I.
And I. And me. That all-absorbing character.
That fascinating creature.
That super special feature.
This.
So every star and every whirling planet and every constellation in the sky revolves around the center of the universe. That lovely thing called I. And there's no way to stop it. No, there's no way to stop it. And I know, though I cannot tell you why.
That as long as I'm living,
just as long as I'm living, there'll be nothing else as wonderful as
I.
Nothing else as wonderful.